Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Kirk French says that in the Baptist home he grew up in, taking just a single sip of alcohol meant you were on a one-way trip to the gutter. Today, he's assistant professor of anthropology and film production and media studies at Penn State University, and his course on the anthropology of alcohol is one of the institution's most popular courses, attracting more than 700 students at a time. As you'll hear in this interview, he says that everyone, even people who don't drink, have a relationship with alcohol that's worth exploring, and that understanding alcohol tells us something about what it is to be human. We cover drunken monkeys, the archaeology of beer cans, the milking of horses, and also why prohibitionist attempts are doomed to fail. Kirk, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really jazzed about being able to talk about this.
Okay, so let's get into it. You teach the largest anthropology of alcohol course in the US, 700 students at a time with alcohol as its organizing principle. Okay, so start off, what does alcohol tell us about humans that say something like stone tools doesn't?
Well, I mean, I guess the main thing that I would say that anthropology shows us, that alcohol shows us, is that, and I'm not sure it's really that different than kinship or stone tools or anything like that. What I think that anthropology does is that it allows us to see that we're way more alike than we are, than we are different. And that once we realize that it can help us better understand and maybe even appreciate our differences. And I think that focusing on alcohol versus focusing on kinship systems or stone tools or something like that, it just makes it way more accessible to students to talk about, and really everybody, you know? I mean, when I'm talking to someone on a flight or something, and I wanted to talk to them about anthropology, and I started talking about stone tools, I might put them to sleep, but if I start talking about, you know, the way people drink all over the world, that's a much easier thing to talk about, and it really gets people interested.
When you're on planes doing that, does everybody start talking about their own relationship with alcohol? Do you get all of their stories?
Exactly. I mean, that is the main thing, is that you end up... So the student thing is easy, right? I mean, like... people are 20, they're 18, 19, 20 years old. You know, everybody loves to drink, and not everybody, but, you know, it's a thing when you're really young. But then there's the adults and everybody else, right? And what is fascinating is that because most people, everybody has an association with alcohol. Everyone. Now, they might not drink at all, and that might be their association. They have a very strong opinion about alcohol, meaning it's unhealthy, it's against my religion, or I love to drink, oh, my mom loves wine, or my dad loves scotch. And everyone thinks they know a lot about alcohol. And you start talking about stone tools or kinship systems. That's a great one because, oh, you know, polyamory and the way people associate cousins and all this kind of stuff. People are like, you're making me feel dumb because I don't understand what you're talking about. But you start talking about wine or whiskey or beer, and people are like, oh, I know something about that. And then you feel like you're a little bit more on the same level. And I think that's a big part of why alcohol works in regards to talking about anthropology.
Okay, so I should start by asking you about your own drinking. What do you drink? What's your history?
Goodness. Well, it's really hard to narrow down. It's like, you know, what's your favorite music or favorite song or whatever. My go-to would be bourbon, but I love Scotch whiskey so much. I like the peaty scotches from Islay. Hazy IPAs. I mean, like when I go to beer, I usually go for the kind of more of the IPA, the hazy IPA. Tequila is so good. I mean, I'm really damn fascinated by so many different types.
But have those you, Have you analyzed your own cultural relationship to alcohol? Do you know why? Have you any thoughts about why you're excited about, you know, what you are?
Oh, yeah. I know exactly why. Mark Twain said, it is the prohibition that makes anything desirable. Mm-hmm. And I grew up very strictly Southern Baptist, evangelical Christian is how I was raised. Now, that's not who I am today at all.
So you've got a whole bunch of teachers and parents who are deeply disappointed in you, Kirk.
Oh, I mean, listen, Baptists don't drink and they don't dance. I mean, and so I was brought up that way, that alcohol is evil. I mean, one sip of alcohol, next thing you know, you're in the gutter with a needle in your arm. I mean, like, that's exactly the philosophy that I was brought up with.
Interesting.
And so, you know, when I got older, I was like, what is this fascinating thing that I've been prohibited to have? And so that definitely plays a role in my interest in alcohol.
All right. So let's talk about, how did you end up looking at this as a professional consideration? I mean, it's one thing to go to university and drink, but most people don't end up doing the anthropology of alcohol. What led you here?
Well, my earliest, I didn't travel as a kid, or, you know, I mean, internationally, I didn't travel. I didn't get on a plane until I was 21 years old, and I went to Guatemala to go to Spanish school and lived with a Guatemalan family. And being down there and then starting to work as an archaeologist in Mexico for years, I became fascinated with the types of alcohols that local people were making, not the stuff you buy in the store, like mezcal and tequila and all your Mexican beers and all that kind of stuff, or Guatemalan rums or whatever, but the things that I had never heard of before, things that you still can't buy in the store today. And just as a young anthropologist, I became fascinated with the idea that there are all these alcohols out there that people are producing in their homes that we've never heard of before. And that has to be something that's happening all over the world. And of course it was, and it is. And that was it. I mean, that was my first foray into it. And then as something I started researching or working toward in that regard, I saw a documentary in 2009 called The Last One. And it's the history of, this guy, Popcorn Sutton, this famous moonshiner. And he makes a mountain still, and he's building the still in the mountains. And I was teaching an intro to archaeology class at the time. And I saw this, and he's making this stone furnace. And when he's done making the moonshine, he takes the copper kettle with him. He takes all the stuff with him, but he leaves this horseshoe shaped pot still, this furnace there. And I thought, well, that's an indelible mark left on the landscape. Like, I talk about burials, or I talk about staircases or temples or whatever people do to the landscape, making terraces. And that's how we look at through archaeology, we look at things that have been left on the landscape to try to glean some sort of human behavior from it. So I thought, man, we could go do that. So I started talking about that in class. And every time I started interjecting that, I would notice the students would start being like, they would pay more attention when I started talking about archaeology of alcohol. So then I developed a whole course on it because I realized that this is, if I want to talk about anthropology and reach a large number of students, maybe using alcohol is a really good way to do it.
What's the fascination for them? Is it because it's easier to grasp, they can map it onto their own lives? Or is it they're all fascinated by their own relationship with alcohol and want to learn more? What is it you think that's so interesting?
Well, from talking to them about it, I mean, some of them, you know, you got your fraternity guys and all of that that are big drinkers, and they have their big frat parties and that kind of American college culture kind of thing. And, you know, they think they're big drinkers, or they are big drinkers, and they think that this will be cool to learn more about it. I've got a lot of international students that come from cultures where, you know, drinking is not allowed. We have a lot of Middle Eastern students at Penn State here at the university I'm at. You know, they're Muslim and they don't drink. And so they're fascinated with I've taken a whole class to learn about how people drink all over the world, because they haven't learned that before. And then there's just people that, they're students And alcohol is such a huge part of college life that in college they can take a class to learn about alcohol. It kind of fits. And it's also a big class and it's a fun class and it's become kind of a thing that, you know, it's got kind of a brand on it in that way. And so now it's something that everybody says like, oh, well, you got to take this class. I mean, about 12% of all the students that come through Penn State take this class now, and which for me, as an, you know, that 12% of all the students that come through this university take an anthropology class is pretty awesome. You know, I'm really proud of that, you know.
That's really interesting. So what's the idea about alcohol and drinking that your students come with? What's the most common sort of self-theory of alcohol and how does that change over the course?
Well, I would think that the main thing that students are at least ignorant of in the sense of alcohol when they're that age, and I was too, and you probably were too when you were 18 or 19 or whatever, is things like ABV and mixing alcohols and all that kind of thing. Like, when I first start talking to them about pours and about the way in which, you know, if you're talking about a 7.5% beer versus your 4% really light Pilsner or whatever, when you drink one of those beers, that's drinking two beers. I mean, that's two servings of alcohol. So if you drink four of those, it's eight of those. You know, it's eight beers instead of four beers. And the pouring of like a mixed drink, and you just pour it in like a, you know, one of these solo cups, right? These like red cups or whatever. You're not even measuring it. You're just pouring it. And you're still thinking, I've only had one drink or I've only had two drinks. But really, you put three pours in there. And when I start talking to them about pours and how to pay attention to your body and what that means, that to me is the biggest kind of wake up for them of realizing that they think they know their bodies because they've had a little bit to drink in high school or whatever. But the idea of drinking for hours at a party is a very different thing, and they all experience it in many of them very negative ways. They get really, really drunk the first few weeks they're at college, and they get really sick because they don't understand their bodies. They don't understand the way that it works, the way the absorption rates work, and the way that everybody's body is different. The level of body fat that one has, the weight that someone is, the height of someone, all these play a role. And talking about that stuff is really eye-opening for them.
You've just given me a whole bunch of thoughts. So I'm speaking to you from an area in Germany, which is a wine area, and it's quite traditional. And when I first arrived here, one of the things I noticed is there's very strict guardrails around how people drink, right? So there's ways that you can consume it with water. If you're female in a bar, they'll stop noticing you if you try and order after a second drink. There's all sorts of kind of social rules about it. And as you're talking, I'm wondering if, I don't know if you've read Michael Pollan's The Omnivore's Dilemma, but he talks about in the modern world, we don't have one cuisine anymore. We've got, you know, Japanese for dinner and then Italian for lunch and whatever. Right. And maybe it's the same with alcohol. Maybe we've lost all of the guardrails around the way we drink because now we're drinking omnivorously. What do you think? Do you think, first of all, my question is twofold. So first of all, am I right that most cultures do actually build sort of guardrails around how you consume and in what context? And secondly, do you think that part of our problem with alcohol now is that all of that's just disappeared?
Well, I do think that there are guardrails for most cultures in the way in which we drink alcohol, what is acceptable, what is not. And to continue with this thing with college drinking, I mean, to me, one of the issues with American college drinking that is such a problem is that the guardrails are off in college. And one of the reasons is because of this archaic system that we have here of this 21 drinking age. And that students leave their, this is the problem that leads to hazing, that leads to the binge drinking, that leads to all these problems that we have here in America that aren't the same kind of problems that you have in other parts of the world. I mean, you have the problem, they exist, but here they're really, it's really amplified. But to me, it's because you just were saying in Germany, there's all these rules and guard, like you go to a bar, you go to a restaurant, they're going to cut you off. They're going to suggest certain things here. You're not allowed to drink until you're 21. You can't go into a bar until you're 21. So what do? You come to college, parent, you're away from your parents. You're not staying at home. There's no oversight. You can do whatever you want. You can't go to the bar, but everybody knows someone who's 21 that can buy alcohol. Mm-hmm. So you end up having house parties. There are no guardrails. There's no bartender. There's nobody pouring proper drinks of saying this is a 1.5 shot and we're going to make a perfect mixed drink. You're getting totally sloshed. You're slurring. You're falling down. You want another drink? Get another drink. Like no one is, that doesn't happen in a bar. You know, there are rules and the bartenders, the bouncers and all of that are there to protect. Part of it is our liability, but also they want their patrons to feel safe. And so all this risky behavior, including sexual assault and all that that occurs, it occurs in these house parties. And so by the drinking age being 21, and most of the time in college, you're under 21, but everybody has access to alcohol, creates this extremely risky environment that causes all of these problems. And so it's something that, yeah. So I don't know if I kind of went off the rails there.
But foundational question. So why do we do it? I mean, alcohol is all of the things the WHO says. It's poisonous, it's toxic, it's addictive, it's intoxicating. So why have we developed a relationship with alcohol? I know that's a really big question.
It is a big question. And it depends on how far we want to go back.
Right back to the beginning. Go right back to the drunken monkey hypothesis or wherever you want to start.
The drunken monkey hypothesis. Well, if we're talking about the drunken monkey hypothesis and this idea of when we started consuming alcohol. I mean, primates have been consuming alcohol for, as fruit eating primates, we've been doing that for 80 million years. But around 10 million years ago, and so when I say consuming alcohol, fruit, it can ferment inside the skin, right? And so, and I've seen this with spider monkeys in Guatemala and in Mexico when the palm fruit, a certain time of the year can start to ferment inside. And so in other words, you have these little bags of alcohol that are still hanging on the trees. And all of the spider monkeys go crazy and they're just going all over this because they just can't wait to eat this stuff up. But what's happened about 10 million years ago, our ape ancestors of modern chimps, gorillas, humans, that kind of thing, we developed a mutation that increased our efficiency of how we metabolize alcohol. And this mutation, which is called ADH4, allowed us to, it improved our metabolism by 40 times in regards to alcohol. This allowed us to do that. Now, from that point on, we were able to do it. It's high in caloric value. I mean, eating a fermented fruit has more calories in it than eating that fruit when it's not fermented. And so you're getting more calories out of it. We're attracted to it. Our olfactory senses attract us to it. So that is where we really started this idea of seeking alcohol out. Producing it, we didn't start doing until 9,000 years ago. But to answer your question of why we do it now and why we've been doing it for, you know, since we've been sedentary, 8, 9, 10,000 years, it's for the same reason. It lowers inhibition. It allows for more free talk. It allows for for relationships to be formed, both political and finding mates, all of that, those types of things. Alcohol can provide that. It's used in ceremonies. All of these reasons are why we do it. But today, to me, the main reason that we do it is because of it lowers stress initially, and it lowers our inhibitions, and it allows us to just kind of relax. And that's what we're seeking. But that only happens in the first drink or two. After that, it's a different thing. To quote one of my favorite singer-songwriters, poets of all time, James McMurtry, he says, "I don't want another drink. I want that last one again."
Yeah,
I think that just nails it.
All right. So most cultures have a culture of intoxication, but some don't. Why don't they? Why is alcohol forbidden for large groups of humans?
I would say it's pretty much for the same reason I just described, which is it lowers inhibitions and it can allow you to act on things that normally you would suppress. You know, your behavior can change. And sometimes, things that we do, we become unfiltered. the yes. things that we say are offensive. We speak our mind too much, that kind of thing. And that can go, really the wrong way quickly. And I think that that can allow us to question authority sometimes, and to revolt. I mean, the anti-saloon league that was in the United States, that helped with prohibition, part of that was, it wasn't to outlaw alcohol. It was to limit saloons, mainly because saloons were where immigrants came and drank, and these rich white men were scared that if you have all these, you know, rich American men, because it was mainly Irish and Scottish folks that were coming in, and when they would get together and drink in these saloons, they were worried, especially with the Irish, that they would revolt if they get all drunk. And so if we get rid of the saloons, they don't have a place to drink anymore. And so people coming together to drink, it can cause problems. And I think that that's why that there are certain places in the certain religions in certain parts of the world that really limit alcohol, which is why, you know, other than the Middle East, parts of the Middle East, the United States is second with its strictness of alcohol laws, to be honest. I mean, when you look at how strict they are, I mean, of course, they're not as strict as the Middle East, but when you compare it to the rest of the world, it's really, the United States comes in second or third.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So when I read the many anti-alcohol articles that are appearing in the New York Times, I always go and have a look at the comments. And comment after comment after comment, and then these are, I presume, fairly educated people in general, how hostile it is to alcohol. And if anybody pops in and says, well, I really enjoy my glass of wine with dinner, everyone else will say, well, you know, you're a closet alcoholic. I think one of them was Eric Asimov, who is the wine critic for the New York Times, wrote a piece saying that, you know, he never has more than three glasses of wine with dinner, and he got mobbed by people saying what an absolute alcoholic he was. Where does that come from?
Well, in America, I mean, there's still this Puritan vein that runs through here, that where this idea of not drinking for religious purposes, or that it's wrong, and it just goes back to the very beginning of early settlers coming over, English settlers coming over, and those ideas taking hold from then on, and the evangelical movement, and once, I mean, that kind of helped feed prohibition. The fact that prohibition happened here, and it also started happening in Scandinavia, it happened in Iceland as well. It was happening. It was moving all over the place in the late 1800s. It was really becoming a thing. But in the United States, it was a big deal, because what was happening then is that, and this all ties in, I don't want to get in too much of the weeds here, but this all ties into when distilled alcohol starts becoming extremely prevalent in the late 1700s and 1800s. It becomes more, I mean, it's been around for a while. It's been around for hundreds of years, but it starts becoming, more distilleries are popping up, and it's becoming more prevalent, easier and cheaper and that kind of thing. And people are consuming it the same way as they would consume cider or beer or whatever. And you got men that are, you know, they're drunk in the morning, they're drunk at noon or whatever, and they're unable to work. Women aren't able to work. They can't take care of their family without the breadwinner coming home and bringing it home. So women come together This all ties into the women's suffrage movement in the United States, women's right to vote. I mean, all of this all comes together at once. And when prohibition was overturned, a lot of whoever was governor of whatever state, so I'm in Pennsylvania, and the alcohol laws here are absolutely crazy.
Yes, you're still a control state, I think. You're still a monopoly state. Is that right?
It is that. And only recently have we been able to buy alcohol in grocery stores. Only recently have we been able to do. They've been changing the rules because of the craft beer industry and the craft alcohol industry, and realizing they're losing out on tax
revenue.
If they don't change in revenue, right? But the whoever was governor when prohibition was repealed in 1833. Here in Pennsylvania, it was a teetotaler. Governor Pinochet was like a total teetotaler, thought alcohol was a scourge of the world. He's quoted as saying, I was going to make alcohol as difficult and as expensive for Pennsylvanians if we have to make it legal again. And he did. But in states where, you know, the governor was like, well, we need to bring alcohol back, their alcohol laws were very liberal. But I think this thread still runs through, to kind of answer your question, of why so many Americans have this very antiquated view of alcohol. But now, with, like you're saying, all of these new studies that are coming out that really any alcohol is really not healthy and all that kind of thing, it's really adding, it's flaming, it's adding wind and, you know, to the fire. People have been saying this is why we should not drink alcohol at all. Now the science is saying that no alcohol is, that any alcohol is bad.
Yeah, some of that science is quite contested. I'll come back to that in a second. But I want to go back to anthropology. So my first question that I've written that I must ask you is, I keep reading that people drank alcohol because water was dangerous. Now, I've read papers that said that's not true, that that's a myth. What's the truth? Did people add alcohol to water because it was contaminated, or is that a myth?
I don't think it's a myth. I think that people were... So if you're talking about like wine, like adding, like, you know, cutting wine with water and that type of thing, I mean, I think that that basic statement of people drank alcohol, people drank wine, it's from my biblical times, people drank wine because the water was bad. My understanding is that people wouldn't have really understood that. They would have understood that by drinking certain things, you might not feel as well, or you might get ill, and drinking wine doesn't make that happen. But by cutting wine with some water, then the effects of the wine are cut down. And I just don't think that it was thought about in the sense that we're going to drink wine because the water's bad. Yeah. I think that it was just like, This is just the thing to do. You just drink some wine with water, and it becomes part of your culture. And you're not really thinking about it like, well, we have to do this because we can't drink the water. The understanding of bacteria and all that stuff wasn't around, and so.
All right, let me run some other ideas past you. So I've read the beer before bread hypothesis, which is that alcohol came first and then farming. And other people dispute that and say, no, it was farming and it was because barley fermented that we got beer. What's your opinion about this?
So my opinion is, so when we look at the first evidence of alcohol in different places in the world, it usually comes just several hundred years or so after we first see the emergence of whatever domesticated crop we're talking about, if it's rice or if it's corn or, you know, if it's barley or wheat or whatever it is. There is that study that came out of, you know, some work that was in Israel, that was pushing this back to about 11,000 years ago, that they're finding that, you know, that they were actually making alcohol first, and that bread came later. I mean, bread did come later, but I think the thing is, okay, I'm getting tongue-tied here, but the point is, my view of this is that when they were first not domesticating, they were gathering wild wheat, right? Wild, what is now beet, barley, or wheat, or whatever. They're gathering that stuff. They're bringing it back. They're grinding it up. They're mixing it with water, and they're making a gruel, like just this kind of porridge stuff that they're eating. They're only learning later that you can kind of bake it and dry it out and it turns into this bread kind of thing. But that gruel is going to ferment. So I don't think that they are growing more crops and starting to domesticate more crops because they like this alcohol stuff that they're drinking or consuming. They're just growing more of it because of this gruel, this porridge-like stuff that they're making. Essentially, it's dough, right? It's just like a watered-down dough. And it would ferment relatively quickly with really low alcohol content. But so I don't think that they were saying, we have to go and find more of these seeds so that we can make alcohol out of it. They're just finding more of these seeds so that they can make more food. And that food item just happened to sometimes have alcohol in it. To me, that's the way I view it. It's
all right. So you've said that agriculture and alcohol co-evolve. Is that always true? Is it inevitable that you're going to get those two things together? Or are there places where that didn't happen?
Yeah, there are places where it didn't happen. And the only place that I know of for certain would be the indigenous folks of Native North America. So if we're talking about like, you know, where I live, Pennsylvania, you know, the East Coast and Midwest of the United States, where the Sioux were. And of course, it would have been before the Sioux. It would have been earlier on. And even out West, I mean, all those groups had some level of agriculture, mainly corn, maize that they were growing. Now, along the border, like Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, there is evidence that the corn they were growing, that in their dental calculus that we've been able from burial remains, there is evidence of alcohol in there, that they were consuming alcohol. Not on a large scale, probably ceremonial, that kind of thing. But we know they were growing corn. We know they were collecting berries. We know they were doing all this stuff in the northeast of the United States. But there's no evidence they were producing alcohol whatsoever. They were using this as a food item and a food item alone. But most other places in the world, they seem to be using their food item also as a way in which to produce alcohol. The reason for that, in my opinion, and things I've read and other people's opinions too, but every culture, almost all cultures have, well, I guess all, have some sort of mind-altering thing that they do. Most of it's a substance of some kind. Usually it's alcohol. Sometimes it could be, you know, other types of things where, you know, pain-induced or fasting or whatever that's going to induce some sort of mind-altering situation. But with the Native North Americans, their mind-altering substance was tobacco. Mm. And so the fact that they had a mind-altering substance that they could rely on that was not a food item is very beneficial, because you're not having to use any of your food to create alcohol. An interview I did with a modern Maya alcohol maker years ago, I thought corn was in it because the Maya used corn for everything. And I asked him how much corn he put in there to make this alcohol. He goes, I don't use, why would I use maize? And I said, well, I thought, what do you use? He said, it's all sugar. I said, well, you have corn growing everywhere. I'm like, why wouldn't you put that in there? And he goes, I need corn to eat and feed my family. Like, why would I use my food to make alcohol? And I thought, that's a really good point. And I bet a lot of early people were like that. It's like, if I have another item that I can use as some sort of, you know, to get what I need out of it, like for ceremonial purposes, why would I use food?
Right, so let's talk about the Mayan. You started with Maya water systems, and then you ended up mapping moonshine streams in Appalachia. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, the connection there really isn't, I mean, the Appalachia thing, you know, turned out to be, you know, more of the moonshine project that I was doing. But the Maya water management thing, the water didn't really lead to anything in regards to that. I mean, the only connection water has from the work that I've done and the alcohol stuff is that, I guess if you ask any brewer or distiller, what is the most important ingredient that goes into your product? They would say the quality of the water, obviously. I mean, that is it. And then of course, you know, the names of several very well-known alcohols like whiskey and vodka, that word means water. I mean, you know, whiskey is from the Gaelic word whiskeba, which is the water of life, whiskey, whiskeba. And then vodka is the diminutive term for voda, which is water. And so really vodka just means little water. So there are those connections with water, but the streams, in my early work with the Maya, I don't really think that there was a strong connection with that, other than my affinity for alcohol and strange alcohols or alcohols I'd never heard of before really started in the Maya area.
So what did you learn about what you're calling strange alcohol? Is the simple lesson people just brew what they've got, or is there something more to it?
It's usually they're using what they have. They have in excess. If they have enough left over, if it's something, in other words, that's why it usually works with staple crops, is that you have to keep enough of your staple crops left to plant for the next year. But as long as you have enough to plant for the next year, you can take some of that and produce alcohol with it. So that's the main thing, is that as long as you have enough left over.
Well, actually, I'm going to ask you a different question, because now I'm thinking from a, because I do report a lot on the business of alcohol. Why are these alcohols strange? Why didn't they enter the corpus of alcohol? What kept them out?
So these, and I almost feel bad that I've used the term strange. And when I use that term, I usually clarify it with, I can view them as strange.
strange to us.
Yeah. Well, what I tell my students is that that term strange or weird, I'll use it a lot when I talk about, what they do is weird or what they do is strange. But the thing is, what you got to keep in mind is that either everything is strange or nothing's strange, because the stuff we do is strange too. I mean, so that kind of thing. But these alcohols that are strange to us, that are different to us. The reason they didn't make it to the mainstream, depends on the alcohol. Some of them don't. They don't store very well, like pulque that's used in central Mexico, that's made from the agave or the maguey plant. It'll go sour after just a few days. And so haven't figured out a way to really, there's a few people that have canned it, but it doesn't really taste the same way because they have to add all these preservatives to it. Some of the stuff is just, it's used for ceremonial purposes only. And so what would be the point of trying to make it more available to a larger group? I mean, the other one is, kumis or arag that is made in Kazakhstan or Mongolia or Baradia, where it's fermented horse milk or camel milk, cat milk. Again, that does not store very well. And when it is bottled, there's a couple of companies that do it. There, so many preservatives and things are added to it, it doesn't taste the same.
Yeah, I think, I can't remember where I read it, but I think there's quite a lot of ancient writing from civilizations that came up against the Mongols and went, oh my God, they drink this fermented stuff. It's disgusting.
I know. I spent 10 days there documenting how they make it and then how they then distill it into something called Chimney Arki. They put it into a still and they end up making this 25% alcohol out of it. I actually make it here at Penn State. I make arag with my students, milk horses at, this is an ag school, right? There's a big agricultural.
Okay. This is something I did not expect when I was researching this. Tell me about milking horses and fermenting it.
I do tell my students that, there might've been a lot of experiences you've had here at Penn State University, but one of the things you will walk away from is that for the rest of your life, you're probably going to be the only person you ever meet that has milked a horse, because I mean, some people milk goats, some people have milked cows, but most of us don't. We don't experience those things. But milking horses, I mean, most farmers haven't milked a horse. So I brought a little bit of starter left from Mongolia when I was there, and I keep it in -80 Celsius freezer. And when we milk the horses, I add a little bit of the starter to it so that it can ferment, and then we make Penn State arag here on campus.
Okay, and what happens to that?
Well, the students get to take part in it. They get to milk the horses, and then we go through the process of watching, letting it ferment for a couple of days, which requires a lot of shaking of it and agitating of it. And then they get to try it, and they all get to try a little sip of it. Not 700 students. It's a different class. That class that's 700 students, that's kids that are 18 to 20. I mean, it's everybody. I teach a smaller class called Ancient Brews where we make alcohol, and that's just 10 students, and they have to be 21 or over to take it. And so that class gets to try a little bit of this.
Okay. All right. That is an unexpected answer, I have to say. Now, you've also treated the university as an archaeological site in its own right. So you've treated beer cans like pottery shards. What have you discovered from doing that?
Well, I mean, the thing with the tailgate archaeology project
was archaeology, that is awesome.
That was really a fun project. So what happened is that I was trying to get the students, I was trying to create something that was more interactive where I would need a lot of students. So a lot of the listeners might not know that, everybody kind of knows what tailgating is, but at Penn State, it's epic. I mean, it turns into this little town of 60,000 people turns into the third largest city in Pennsylvania on a home football game. Upwards of 200,000 people come into this area. I mean, our stadium seats 100,000, and then there'll be 100,000 more that are out tailgating around the stadium. It's enormous and it's mind blowing to see. And the amount of trash that's left behind always boggled my mind. And as an archaeologist, I thought, man, this would be like a great garbology project, which is like the study of garbage, right? And like looking at it. Because most of what we do as archaeologists is go through ancient remains, right? Ancient garbage and that kind of stuff. So I thought, man, I could get a bunch of students to go out and it'd be two-part. One would be have an ethnographic component. We go out during game day and we go to different parts of the tailgating area around the stadium and way out away from the stadium. And we interview people about what they drink, how much they spend, what they eat, how much they spend, that kind of stuff. And we GPS their location of where they are. And then we come back the following day, the following morning at 5 a.m. before all the trash is picked up. We go back to those same locations and we go through that trash that's left behind to see if we can, as archaeologists, piece together something that is similar to what the people were telling us that they were doing, what they were consuming or how much they spent. And this shows the students that, you know, that this is why anthropology is not an exact science, is that what people tell you and what is actually happening can often be different. And often what you find left behind, people might have taken some of their trash with you. So you might not, you're not seeing the whole picture with archaeology. So it's kind of showing them this hands-on thing with how anthropology and archaeology works.
Okay, so the number one thing that alcohol researchers, medical alcohol researchers, have to, you know, worry about is what people say about their drinking and what they actually drink are two very different things. So what does your archaeology, what does your garbology show?
Okay, so what this showed, which was the most interesting, wasn't necessarily about what people said and what we saw, because the trash could have been moved around. It matched up okay. That part wasn't the real highlight. The highlight was this, is that when I'm working in Mesoamerica at some, you know, at ancient Maya ruins or whatever, when you're in the center where the big temples are and all that kind of stuff, the pottery and all that kind of stuff that you find around there is really high-end stuff. That's where the elite lived. When you get out to the hinterlands, like further away from the city center, that's where the poorer folks lived. And so you're going to see more utilitarian pottery and cheaper things and all that kind of stuff. Well, the giant stadium here at Penn State, Beaver Stadium, this giant stadium, the parking spots, the tailgating spots right around it are $10,000 a season. So a minimum of $10,000. So the wealthy alumni are the ones that are right around the stadium. The parking spots that are like half a mile away or more, they're $40 a car load. So what socioeconomic status is what we were seeing. The types of booze that was being consumed up near the stadium or the temple, you're getting your high-end, your Grey Goose vodkas, your Maker's Mark bourbons, you're getting your, you know, really nice tequilas, your craft beers. You get out into the hinterlands a mile away, half a mile away, you've got your really cheap beers, your really cheap vodkas, your really cheap bourbons. And I'm showing the students that you can see socioeconomic status just from the trash left behind around this stadium.
Okay, so I have a confession, and it's a really bad confession. When I was learning about wine, I used to go around and I used to look at people's recycling, what they put out. And what I worked out from that is that there are some very posh areas that have no culture of connoisseurship whatsoever. The wine bottles they put out were complete shit compared to what I was expecting them to do. So in your study of different cultures and the way people drink, have you seen these cultures of connoisseurship emerge, or is alcohol always just alcohol?
Well, it's that question is so awesome, the timing too, because to continue with this archaeology, this tailgate thing, the one outlier was that the beer that we also found up near the stadium where the wealthy people were, a lot of cheap beer too. And when I asked people about it, you know, like why, they said, well, that's what I drank in college. Like I'm back at a, like it's about nostalgia. Like, man, that cheap Natty Light, that cheap Miller Light or whatever I was drinking, that's what I drank in college. And that I'm here at a football game. That makes me feel like I'm young again. I'm drinking cheap beer again. And so I think that there is a nostalgia sometimes. And when you said this about looking at people's recycling, I do the same thing.
Do you?
I do.
Not many people in wine will admit to doing it, but I know that people do it.
And I'm like, oh man, that is so horrible. Like, gosh, like that poor guy or whatever, you know, I'm thinking those things or if I'm walking around where the students live and they'll just be like, it's just all cheap beer. And I'm like, oh, I bet that house is rented by students. And I can kind of figure out like maybe what's going on. But your question about this you know, of being like connoisseurs of, there's so much high-end alcohol now. I mean, there's so much small batch stuff that I think people really get, there's a lot more people that are also looking for really high-end quality alcohols. And I'd say that for the most part, it is somewhat affordable because a lot of people's drinking has changed where they don't, especially this newest generation, where they might not drink every day, but when they do drink, they're gonna buy something that's higher end and they're gonna enjoy it.
I suppose what I'm asking is, if you go way back to the Mayans or whatever, is it very clear that some people are going, or some monkeys are going, look, I like that tree, not this one? Or is alcohol just alcohol? Or do you see early on that some alcohols are more prized than others?
Wow, that's a good question, but I don't know if I would, I don't think I have a good answer for that, because then if you're talking about in, you know, long ago, there would have been so few options of what you would have consumed. Most cultures would have had one or two types of alcohols that they would have been using. And it would have only been mainly used by elites or in ceremonial purposes. Like if you're talking about the Maya, for instance, I mean, the normal population wouldn't have been making balque, you know, balche, and they wouldn't have been making this chocolate kind of beer wine or kind of thing, something that the elite would have been doing. But I don't think that you would have had things like that that would have been more coveted. If you're talking about Europe, there would have been, you know, some more varieties of wines and some more varieties of even distilled alcohols after the 1500s that I'm sure would have been more sought after. Definitely with whiskey, for sure, by 1600 and 1700.
All right. So let's talk about the modern world, which is we're now seeing a push towards abstinence. At the time of recording, the US dietary guidelines have just come out and everybody's very upset because they didn't recommend lower amounts of alcohol drinking. There's definitely a health push in that direction. Do you think it's possible to engineer alcohol out of human life, or is it something we're always going to have, or what we're seeing at the moment, is this just a dip and we'll go back to sort of more normal ways of drinking when it's over?
No, I think it'll always be there. I think it'll ebb and flow like it has in the past. I mean, there was a huge spike in alcohol consumption, at least in the United States during the 60s. If you think about like Mad Men time period, you know, the 60s and that kind of, and in the 70s, there was a decrease in alcohol, it increased again in the 80s. But what we're seeing now, in my opinion, is the spike of alcohol consumption that happened during COVID, during lockdown. It lasted, I mean, my alcohol consumption increased. Almost everyone I know's alcohol consumption increased during COVID, during the lockdown. And then that lasted for a while after. And I think that we're starting to step back from it, from being a little more health conscious of going like, well, I can't continue drinking that way. I think this kind of is a knee-jerk reaction to, maybe not knee-jerk, but it is a reaction to what happened during COVID, that we're starting to see a more of a push for a decline in it. But I do not think it can be, I don't think it can't be engineered out. It can't be, it's always going to be there, and it is too ingrained in so many aspects of so many different cultures throughout the world. A decrease, yes. And I think as people become more conscious of their health, and more studies come out that show that, you know, that I know that what happened in the United States with the new guidelines, and almost all the guidelines that the new health secretary is coming out with, I don't want to get political, but like, it's all kind of, it'll go back the other direction as soon as somebody else.
Let me run something by you. So I read a lot of the public health literature on alcohol, and there was a big report published earlier this year. So public health sociologists and so on have been tracking young people drinking since 1971. So there's about 50-something years of data. And what they're all reporting in multi-countries is that, you know, young people today, I'm old enough to say that, young people today are not drinking the way people did in the past. And one of the reasons that they have postulated for that, among many reasons, being more risk averse and so on, is that social media is the technology that's actually substituting for what alcohol once did. So if you're very young and worried about being, you know, rejected, it's really scary to approach somebody. So you used to use alcohol like that, because then certainly in Australia you could pretend that it didn't happen if it didn't work out well. But social media allows you to do that now, because you can just send somebody an emoji and it lowers the risk level. And so alcohol as a social technology is being displaced by social media. What do you think?
Wow, that's the first I've heard of that, and that makes sense to me. I mean, I really like that. I want to look more into that, because it does.
I will send you the name of the book. It is the worst written piece of academic crap I've ever read. It took me two reads to get through and understand what they were talking about, but it's very interesting.
Well, because what I was going to say to that, though, is, because I didn't know that's where you were going with it, is I have a theory, and it's based on conversations I've had with people and some things that I've read, but like, especially here, the ease of how one can get cannabis and how cannabis is now viewed, I think, and I've asked my students about this, I mean, like, they would much rather, you know, take a hit or eat a gummy or whatever it is than to drink alcohol to lower those inhibitions. Mm-hmm. And that drinking less for college students are drinking less. And I think that here, the ease of which you can get marijuana in all different forms, I think that's really changed. Because when I was in college, you know, I mean, well, up until 10 years, I mean, like, all cannabis purchases were illegal. So you had to know someone who had it, and it was illegal, and it was scary. You might get caught or busted, go to jail, whatever. But now, you can do that and you don't have to drink, or you drink less.
But hang on a second. I mean, they're very different drugs. Is cannabis a good substitute for alcohol? Because, well, you know what? They do different things.
They do. But there was a study done about a year ago. I saw a paper about this. I want to say the study was done in Scandinavia, in Norway, I think. But they studied a group of people, hundreds, where they looked at how they drank after they consumed, or after they ingested cannabis. They did different levels and different tech, and they drank less. So if you are high just a little bit when you start the process of drinking, you're going to drink slower, you're going to drink less. And I've experienced this too. If I end up ingesting some cannabis and I'm going to go have some drinks somewhere, I probably will drink several drinks less than I would if I wouldn't have. You're right, they do different things, but lowering the inhibition on really low levels, it does do that, but it can slow down or limit the amount of alcohol that you desire through that evening. So yeah, that study was pretty cool, because I was like,
we should swap studies. I'll put it in the show notes. I'd like to read that. So are you seeing your students drinking differently than when, say, you first started teaching?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I've only been teaching this class for seven or eight years. Oh yeah. I mean, when I ask them about how much they pregame, which is how many they drink before they go out, or how many of them drink at all, or how much, what they drink, is it, you know, is it liquor versus beer? That has changed, and the number of students that do drink and number of nights a week they do drink has decreased a little bit.
It's interesting. All right, so finally, what's your next project? What are you looking at next?
Well, I mean, mainly I do film. I mean, I make films, ethnographic films, and so that's mainly where my research is that I work with different groups. I have two films out and a third one that's coming out later this year. It doesn't have anything to do with alcohol. Not really. But the alcohol project, I mean, I want to do I haven't done the tailgate. I would like to do the tailgate archaeology thing again with the students to get more data on that. But I don't have any big alcohol trip plans or, you know, research in regards to alcohol anytime in the near future.
All right. Well, look, Kirk, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, and it was fun. Look forward to swapping those articles.
You've You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.